Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, September 24th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page, Mental Health Analysis Test Court Timeline. Alleged kidnapper killer's lawyers work to piece together man's social history from Urbana. A request by attorneys for accused kidnapper and murderer Brent Christensen for more time to decide if they'll present a mental health defense illustrates what a labor-intensive process they are involved in. In a 30-page motion filed on Friday, the four-attorney defense team asked Judge James Chedid for a hearing on their request. If granted, it will likely mean the trial now set for April 3, 2019, would have to be pushed back. Christensen, 29, has marked two birthdays behind bars since his arrest almost 15 months ago for the kidnapping of Yingying Zhang. The 26-year-old Urbana woman was a visiting University of Illinois scholar from China, was last seen June 9, 2017, at a campus bus stop. Her body has never been found. Christensen was arrested on his birthday, June 30, 2017, on a kidnapping charge. 13 weeks later, a federal grand jury indicted him on additional charges of kidnapping resulting in death and lying to the FBI. The former charge put Christensen in the crosshairs for the death penalty. Federal public defenders were appointed just over a year ago after private lawyers withdrew from representing Christensen when the specter of the death penalty was raised, saying they did not have the resources to defend him. In Friday's motion, the federal defender said they spent the first 5 months of the year working on Christensen's behalf, trying to keep the government from seeking the death penalty while preparing for trial under a wholly unrealistic and unreasonable schedule. The government announced in January it would seek the death penalty. In the 7 months since, the defense team has said it's been working diligently to piece together his social history so they can identify the appropriate mental health experts who are willing and available to evaluate him. Their motion outlines 7 steps related to that process the lawyers must complete before deciding if they intend to introduce evidence of Christensen's mental condition during either the guilt phase of his trial or the penalty phase. As of Friday, they were about halfway there, having pulled together enough information on Christensen's and numerous family members from several different generations to conclude they need to consult at least 3 types of mental health experts. Their work has involved interviews with many different witnesses who are located in at least 6 different states and gathering records from numerous sources in a large number of different jurisdictions. Based on what they learned, they have hired 2 of the 3 experts, but neither has seen Christensen yet. One is scheduled to see him in October and the other in October and November. The lawyer said they hope to know by December when those 2 will be able to give their opinions. By December, they added, the 3rd expert will have been hired and should be able to give them a timetable for getting Christensen evaluated and offering an opinion. They asked Shadid if to set a status conference in December for the purpose of giving them a new deadline by which they can inform the government of their decision whether they will be presenting evidence of Christensen's mental condition. Trying to illustrate why it takes so long, the lawyers quoted from American Bar Association guidelines that say the persons deciding death have to consider anything in a defendant's life that could spare him the ultimate punishment. The guidelines say it's up to his lawyers to dig that up through unparalleled investigation into personal and family history, including medical, family, social, educational, employment, criminal history, and military service. A multi-generational investigation extending as far as possible vertically and horizontally frequently discloses significant patterns of family dysfunction and may help establish or strengthen a diagnosis or underscore the hereditary nature of a particular impairment. At least in the case of the client, this begins with the moment of conception. And from those who served, hundreds of copter missions flown under fire from Champaign. To rescue soldiers on the ground, Larry Olson often flew his Huey helicopter through heavy fire in Vietnam. He even saved North Vietnamese soldiers on rare occasions. Born in 1948, he'd lived in Japan, Montana, and Florida, among other places, as a military brat. For a couple of those years, he lived in Champaign. He graduated from high school in 1966, and because his lottery number made being drafted likely, he enlisted instead of instead to get a better assignment. I was going to be a radio guy, Olson said, but then I thought about flight school. His good balance and sharp eyes took him to flight school at Fort Walters, the Army's primary helicopter school. Officers asked a group of soldiers who's got fixed-wing experience, and Olson instead found himself training on a Hughes TH-55 light helicopter. After medical training for the wounded he would be transporting, Olson arrived in Vietnam December 10, 1969. He can remember the exact day because it was his 21st birthday. It was still going pretty heavy, he said of 1970. The Tet Offensive was over. We were generally fighting the North Vietnamese Army, not the Viet Cong. Olson was on 3 days, then off the next day, and so on. And those shifts could be really full. Some days we'd go out 6, 7, 8 times to pick up the wounded, sometimes once. The missions could range from the routine to the very urgent. You get pretty close with the medics. You can learn a lot from them, calling what they did magic. The missions could take place at any time, and there could be just one of several soldiers needing to be picked up, challenging the Huey's capacities. The flights came under intense fire from the ground, but the NVA had no helicopters or planes in his area. He estimates that he may have made almost 800 missions in his single year in Vietnam at Cho Lai Base area near Nha Dan. His ship was forced down 3 times. Once an American soldier's grenade rolled on the floor. A soldier died on an early mission during dust-off, an emergency patient evacuation. I can still see his face, the pilot recalled. At another point, his crew chief was shot in the face with a slug nestled near his jugular. I could see it, Olson said. He survived. Despite all of the rounds hitting his helicopter, Olson recalls the time with some fondness. My tour was great. I had a job I liked, even if it was hard at times. After the war, Olson realized that he, in fact, had PTSD. He has had therapy visits at the VA Ileana Healthcare System. Now, in an ELKS program, he encourages veterans to seek treatment. If you weren't there, you don't understand. It's good to talk to people who do understand. Also on the front page, glimmer of hope, DNA still in play, family, just pray this guy gets caught. Teresa Dilly of Urbana can't wait until her family can say, we got him, Mom. It was 17 years ago Saturday, September 22, 2001, when Eastern Prairie firefighters found her mother, Linda Smith, 59, dead in her bed in her longtime home in the Wilbur Heights neighborhood just north of Champaign. A neighbor had called 911 with report of a fire at the residence at 302 Paul Avenue that morning. She was a good mom, crazy about her grandkids, and was expecting her first great-grandchild, Dilly said. She just loved being around people. Mrs. Smith, who had worked at the Kmart in Champaign for almost 30 years, was living with heart problems and recovering from bypass surgery at the time of her death. But an autopsy would show more than the cause of her death, a heart attack. She had also been sexually assaulted. She was a hard worker, she had a big heart, and she didn't deserve to die this way, an emotional Dilly said. According to Lieutenant Kurt Anderson, head of the Champaign County Sheriff's Office Investigations Division, Mrs. Smith had the heart attack during the course of sexual assault. Her attacker may have seen a can of gasoline outside of the house and decided the best way to conceal the crime was to set fire to the residence. The house has since been demolished. Investigators were able to recover a DNA sample, which was sent to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab for a profile. In November of 2002, we learned it was linked to an aggravated criminal sexual assault in Carbondale on August 8, 2001, and another in Silver Spring, Maryland, in Montgomery County on July 5, 1995. Obviously, he meets the definition of a serial rapist. The women in Carbondale and Silver Spring survived the attacks. Dilly said she'd tell the man who attacked her mother, I hope you get what's coming to you, and I'm sure you will, and I'll be there to make sure you sit in prison for a long time, hopefully until you die. Even though investigators from all three jurisdictions know the assaults were committed by the same man, his identity is still unknown. His name does not show up in the DNA database. Apperson declined to say if the sheriff's office is turning to Parabon Nono Labs in Virginia for help in identifying the man whose DNA matches the assaults. The company's use of advances in DNA technology, combined with genetic analysis, recently led to the arrest of Michael Henslick in the 2009 fatal stabbing of Holly Cassano of Muhammad. This is an open and active investigation, Apperson said, and I think it would be ill-advised if I sit there and broadcast what we will do, but every option is on the table when it comes to DNA. Apperson said investigators are working with the other two jurisdictions, mainly with Carbondale police, to solve the crimes. He said there are common threads among the three attacks. All occurred in college towns, and the victims lived near railroad tracks. Apperson said the description provided by the two other victims is similar. He used the threat of force. He's black, 25 to 27, 5 feet 10 inches tall, thin build, and weighs 150 to 160 pounds. Apperson also said the suspect sexually assaulted the woman in Maryland for 3 hours while armed with a knife and smelling of alcohol and cigarettes. I just think that we're going to have to get lucky, Apperson said, and I think just like on the Holly Cassano case, when you put in a lot of hard work, you generate luck. Those with information about Mrs. Smith's murder, which happened a week and a half after the September 11th terrorist attacks, are urged to call Champaign County Sheriff's investigators at 217-384-1213, or if wishing to remain anonymous, Crime Stoppers at 217-373-8477. Even if you think we already know, call us, because maybe we don't know. If anyone out there knows of a black male who had ties with Silver Spring, Maryland, Carbondale, and Champaign, we need to know. I still believe we're going to find this person and find out who he is. Meanwhile, Dilly and her family turn to each other to get through their anger and grief. We always think she's with us in spirit. We just hold on to the good times and just pray that something comes up and this guy gets caught. There's no greater loss than your mother. She's like the rock. Statute upheld, but are hospitals really winner? From Champaign, since Illinois' controversial hospital tax exemption law was upheld by the state Supreme Court last Thursday, the decision has been hailed as a big win for nonprofit hospitals. What's unclear from what lawyers are saying in the aftermath is which side actually gained ground. Hospitals clinging to their charitable tax exemptions, or taxing authorities that don't see hospitals as charities at all. At issue in the case filed by Cook County resident Constance Oswald against the Illinois Department of Revenue was the constitutionality of a 2012 change in the state tax code that set fairly simple standards for hospitals to meet in seeking property tax exemptions. That is, they must show they're giving away at least as much in charitable assistance in their communities as they'd have to pay in taxes. While the Supreme Court upheld the statute, it also made it clear hospitals seeking tax exemptions have a second test to meet. Additionally, the hospital must show that the subject property meets the constitutional test of exclusive charitable use, said the opinion written by Justice P. Scott Neville, Jr. For retired University of Illinois law professor John Colombo, the decision leaves Illinois hospitals and taxing districts with uncertainty. While the court made it clear that the new state law was an addition, not a replacement, for constitutional requirements, the justices didn't spell out what a nonprofit hospital has to do to meet the test of exclusive charitable use. Does the exclusive use test require some minimum amount of charity care? Some evidence that hospital operations are primarily designed to serve the poor? Or is simply operating a community hospital open to all itself a charitable endeavor regardless of the amount of charity care actually provided? The Oswald case didn't answer that question, and it could be a few years before the issue is before the High Court. If the Carle Foundation's lawsuit against state and local taxing authorities moves, once again, through the appeals process. The Carl case, in which Carl is seeking a refund of about $26 million in property taxes it paid for several years prior to 2012, has already been reviewed by the Supreme Court, but last year was sent back to Champaign County for further hearing, and it's now set for trial in January. Carl clearly meets the test for an exemption under the state statute, but the key issue will be whether it can meet the test for exclusive charitable use. What the Supreme Court has essentially done is say, look, you don't have to argue about the statute anymore. Instead, the argument is going to be, are you a charity? Technically, that means, is the property used for charitable purposes? And that argument has always been part of the underlying law of exemption. Steve Flaum, the Chicago lawyer representing Carl, said it's easy to focus on the longstanding controversy in Champaign County over hospital tax exemptions when, in fact, hospitals have a long history in Illinois of being tax exempt and the state constitution hasn't changed. Flaum doesn't see any ambiguity in the Supreme Court decision about what hospitals need to do to meet the constitutional test, and he sees Carl being in a solid position heading to trial. The Oswald decision clearly simplifies and clarifies issues, and we believe provides a roadmap for what the Carl Foundation has to prove during the trial. Proving Carl meets the state's statutory requirements for exemption will be easy. Carl gives away many times the amount in charity than the value of its tax burden. It will take us less than a day to prove that. The second thing we have to show is we are using our property in a way that satisfies the charitable use requirement. That focuses on the ways in which the foundation provides care to an indefinite number of persons, basically health care to anyone who needs it, regardless of their ability to pay. It's hard to imagine how the Supreme Court decision could have been better for nonprofit hospitals. The Supreme Court has delivered a resounding victory not only hospitals, but the patients they serve. Fred Grosser, the attorney representing Urbana and Cunningham Township in the Carl lawsuit, contended hospitals are going to have to show considerably more than whether they serve everyone regardless of ability to pay to meet the constitutional standards. He views the Supreme Court's decision as about a 90% win for taxpayers and taxing districts. Contrary to the claims of Carl and the Illinois Hospital Association, this decision is devastating to them. Also from Urbana, it will be an epicenter of discoveries, updated building rededicated in visionaries' honor. To students and faculty at the University of Illinois, Everett Lab is a birthplace of the electrical engineering advances that revolutionized technology, named for a visionary in the engineering world. To the Everett family, it is that and much more, a living memorial to William Everett, who donated his body to science when he died in 1986. His ashes were later scattered around to forgive William Everett III for getting choked up at Friday's rededication of the 70-year-old building, which underwent a $55 million renovation to become the home of the U of I Department of Bioengineering. The work was funded in part by $20 million from the Granger Foundation, which insisted the building still carry Everett's name. "For that I am grateful," William Everett III said on Friday, pausing to collect himself as the audience applauded. "We're honored for his name to be still here and at the forefront of technology will still have his name on it, because that's what he believed." A series of speakers emphasized Friday how fitting it was for Everett's name to be on the building designed to be the epicenter of the next revolution in engineering on the biomedical front. The building, formerly home to the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, now houses the Bioengineering Department and the Carl Illinois College of Medicine, created to fuse engineering and medicine to transform healthcare. "We believe it will be an epicenter of discoveries that will be life-changing through the 21st century and beyond." Everett, dean of the college from 1949 to 1968, and head of the Electrical Engineering Department for 4 years before that, joined the U of I after World War II and brought the engineering program to national prominence. He essentially created the modern engineering curriculum, believing faculty members should conduct research and incorporate it into their teaching, a novel idea later copied nationwide. Everett brought the brightest minds to Illinois and inspired them to do great things, including giants such as two-time Nobel laureate John Bardeen, who co-invented the transistor, his protege, LED inventor Nick Holiak, and William Fry, a pioneer in the field of therapeutic ultrasound. Everett defined the engineering curriculum and turned Illinois into a world leader, said Professor Rashid Bashir, former head of the bioengineering department and now executive associate dean of the medical school. When Everett entered college at Cornell University, there was no such thing as an electrical engineering degree, his grandson said. Everett studied civil and mechanical engineering and earned an advanced degree in physics. He saw beyond the practical aspects of his field the creation of transmission of electricity and became a pioneer in wireless communications. During World War II, he was recruited to lead the operations research staff in the Army Signal Corps, making important contributions to radar development and inventing the radar altimeter, still used in aircraft today to measure altitude. Until then, engineering wasn't considered to be on par with scientific fields such as physics or mathematics. Engineering professors focused on teaching fundamentals while doing research on the side, and students went on to jobs at Bell Labs or other companies that did the bulk of the research at the time. That changed after the war because of Everett and others such as Vannevar Bush, head of the Carnegie Institute, who persuaded President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to create the National Research Defense Council to develop technology that would help the Allies win the war. Bush had recruited Everett to join that effort. They saw that technology would change the world, the younger Everett said, and would require engineers, mathematicians, and physicists working together. Everett believed in collaboration among those fields and helped elevate engineering from a mechanical art to a top research discipline. He saw what great minds could do together. When he got to the University of Illinois, they gave him a blank slate. As a child, the younger Everett knew his grandfather as the man who taught him to swim, who would take the train to their home in Utah to spend one-on-one time with each grandchild, and whose invention gained him entry into numerous airplane cockpits. One time I told the pilot my grandfather was the inventor of the radar altimeter, and he was so enthralled he had me sit in the pilot seat as he went through the checklist and had me start the engine. But the younger Everett didn't understand the depth of his legacy until he spoke to U of I faculty members earlier this year during a ceremony for an endowed professorship in his grandfather's name and took a deep dive into his past. He said the new faculty lives up to his grandfather's vision of engineering as an interdisciplinary field devoted to the motto, learn and apply, to benefit mankind. He foresaw it and he would be absolutely ecstatic about it. This is actually part of the vision he had. He believed that engineering was the answer to all things. Microelectronics advances made during Everett Labs earlier incarnation led to development of the semiconductor, computer chips, and set in motion the digital revolution we're seeing today. The new version with the $10 million Jump Trading Medical Stimulation Center, a virtual reality suite and high-tech labs, will bring together engineers, physicians, and students to attack global challenges in healthcare. They are already working on new prosthetics and therapeutic devices, early detection of cancer, and other advances that will improve the quality of life and reduce health costs. If we have only half the impact that your grandfather had, or one-third the impact, we'll be proud. And from the business page, just ask in, what's the forecast for this winter? We don't really know at this point. The Old Farmer's Almanac is predicting a warm and wet winter, and the Farmer's Almanac is predicting a biting cold, snowy winter. There will be some snow in the early part of December, with forecasts showing it will be messy at Christmas, said Peter Geiger, editor of the Farmer's Almanac. But meteorologists say both almanacs are basically pseudoscience. Completely useless, said Jeff Frame, a University of Illinois weather professor. This year, at least one of them is going to be dead wrong. The almanacs predict the weather down to the day months in advance, but we fundamentally cannot predict day-to-day weather beyond 7 to 10 days in advance. While some private companies are trying to make long-term forecasts, Frame said it's still an area of very active current research in weather science. And the National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center makes broad 3-month forecasts, but nothing down to the specific day, as the almanacs do. Its outlook for December through February indicates a 39% chance of above normal temperatures in Champaign, 33% chance of normal temperatures, and a 28% chance of below normal temps. And for precipitation, there's an equal chance of above normal, below normal, and average precipitation this winter. The almanacs don't say how they reach their forecasts, but Geiger said it's based on a mathematical formula developed in the 1800s that takes into account sunspots, tides, and the position of the planets. They're very tight-lipped about what they actually do. Folks like me and other meteorologists kind of want this to go away. And a letter to the editor. Kneeling is like spitting on graves. It's football season, and another kneeling controversy rears its head. Here's a little history to explain why some of us don't care for it. Star Spangled Banner was adopted by the Navy in 1889 and played during morning and evening colors and for special occasions. Other branches soon followed, as the Army has described it, the day cannot officially start until the flag is raised and honor is given to all those who came before. In 1916, President Woodrow Wilson signed an executive order making it our national anthem. The official adoption of the new anthem at sporting events occurred during Game 1 of the 1918 World Series between the Chicago Cubs and the Boston Red Sox in Chicago. With 100,000 war casualties so far and 4 post office workers killed the day before in a bombing in Chicago, the anthem was played to honor their sacrifices in keeping with the military tradition. Red Sox infield Fred Thomas in the Navy and granted furlough to play in the series, turned toward the flag and gave a military salute. The symbolism and purpose behind playing the anthem is not about patriotism or somebody's rights. It's about honor and respect for those who came before. Kneeling is akin to spitting on their graves. I wonder if today's protesting athletes and their supporters even know how disrespectful this is. Ken Foley, St. Joseph. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, September 24th. Please stay tuned.